Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a scathing report from Massachusetts gambling regulators on Wynn Resorts and sexual misconduct allegations. Wynn's CEO apologizes.
There were many victims, and those victims felt powerless. And for that, I am deeply remorseful.
Also today, vetting the drivers for services like Uber and Lyft.
Ultimately, they dove into an industry which was not perfect and not totally safe.
And the new rent control debate in Massachusetts.
We deserve to be able to afford to rent in the place where we work.
The evidence is very clear. Rent control doesn't work the way it's intended to work.
All this plus some of the finalists for the Pulitzers of Food. Coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Massachusetts gambling regulators have released a blistering, more than 200-page report on their investigation of the sexual misconduct allegations involving Las Vegas casino operator Wynn Resorts. Today's the first day of what's expected to be a three-day State Gaming Commission hearing on the investigation and on whether Wynn can still run a $2.6 billion Encore casino in Everett. WBUR's Callum Borchers is covering today's hearing, and he joins us with more. Hi there, Cal.
Hey there, Deb.
So this report culminates an almost year-long investigation by the State Gaming Commission. The report was publicly released this morning. What would you say are the most significant findings?
Well, investigators didn't say whether the sexual misconduct allegations against Steve Wynn are true or false, but they did say that Wynn Resorts mishandled those allegations and then on top of it hid those allegations from regulators when the Gaming Commission was awarding the coveted Greater Boston Casino license back in 2014. Karen Wells directs the Commission's Investigations and Enforcement Bureau, and here's some of what she told the commissioners this morning.
This investigation also revealed the apparent existence of a culture at the company where employees hesitated to report allegations of sexual misconduct against Mr. Wynn to management, with employees fearful of employment-related consequences or believing that reporting to management would be futile.
So that bit about the company culture is really key, Deb, because to keep its casino license, Wynn Resorts now has to convince the Gaming Commission that its culture has changed.
Hmm. And now I'm told that much of Wynn's senior management team is there at this hearing before the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. How are those executives, the Wynn executives, responding?
Well, that's right. They are all sort of lined up in the room together. And as the report came out this morning, the company did issue a written statement saying it doesn't contest any of the report's findings. But we haven't really heard from many of the managers at the hearings just yet. We did hear briefly from Chief Executive Matt Maddox, however. He gave a 5-minute opening statement, and he set up what looks like it's going to be a 3-pronged argument to keep the casino license, Deb. Number one, he said he was truly sorry for the way the company handled misconduct allegations. Second, he said that Wynn Resorts has cleaned house, including cutting ties with Steve Wynn himself. And number three, he talked about the toll on the company's workers.
And it wasn't just our 25,000 people that were worried, it was their families. We had 75,000 people worried about what this future is going to be. What are their future going to be? So I knew when I took over on February 7th that we had to be strong, be fast, and get to the truth.
So as he's talking about those employees, Deb, you know, Maddox didn't specifically mention the 5,800 planned jobs at Encore Boston Harbor, but I think talking about Wynn employees in general could be a way of reminding regulators that there are a lot of jobs riding on this decision.
Hmm. And so, as we said, today was the first day of a 3-day hearing. What do you think we'll be hearing the next 2 days? Will we hear more from Wynn, do you think, or what, Cal?
I think we will hear more from the Wynn side than we have today. And I think a lot of the time is going to be devoted to determining whether the new leaders at Wynn Resorts are fit to hold this casino license. Remember, the Gaming Commission originally granted the license to a management team that is basically all gone now. So commissioners will want to question the newcomers. Wynn has added three women to its board just last August, one of whom is the former White House Press Secretary Dee Dee Myers. And Deb, as I stepped out of the room to talk with you, Myers was actually beginning to field some questions from commissioners. And as you might expect, they were asking her about her time in the Clinton White House, which, you know, also has a reputation for being a place where sexual misconduct could fester. And so these are the kinds of things they want to find out, whether someone who's been in that workplace is in the right position to clean up Wynn Resorts.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, Cal, can you remind us for a second of how did we get here and why does an agency like the State Gaming Commission have this power to investigate this company and potentially pull its license?
Right. So the Gaming Commission has emphasized over and over again, this is not a criminal proceeding, so there are going to be no charges that result from this. But the Gaming Commission is the state agency that is charged with, first of all, awarding the license, which it did in 2014. But also, it has also repeatedly said that it is in a constant state of evaluating the fitness of the license holder. That is something they can check over and over again. So one possible scenario here is that they just let Wynn Resorts keep the license that it got. Another is that it revokes the license. And then the third option is perhaps somewhere in between where it says, hey, you can keep the license, but we're going to impose some kind of conditions. That's sort of what we saw in Nevada recently, Deb, when the Gaming Commission there let Wynn Resorts keep its license, but hit it with a $20 million fine.
And again, because of the same accusations that first surfaced in the Wall Street Journal accusing Wynn founder Steve Wynn of sexual misconduct.
That's exactly right. So all of this was a result of that January 2018 article in the Wall Street Journal, which detailed a pattern over decades. The most serious accusation was a manicurist who alleged that Steve Wynn had raped her in his office in Las Vegas in 2005. Wynn paid a $7.5 million settlement in that case, but the company, according to the report we saw today, did not even launch an internal investigation.
So what are some of the possible outcomes here then, Cal, would you say?
Well, I think the most likely scenario is that you see some type of disciplinary action or conditions or follow-on where you say the commission is going to continue to review the status. You know, an all-out revocation of the license would really throw a lot of planning off. You know, the Encore Boston Harbor is supposed to open in June. As I mentioned, there's 5,800 jobs planned there. So, you know, that is a possibility. You know, and then the other possibility is that they just say, hey, you can keep the license and move on as planned. But again, that middle ground may be the most likely scenario where there's a fine coming or there are some strict conditions placed on Wynn Resorts and its operations going forward.
And I know, you know, no one can really read the tea leaves here, but I'm just wondering, because you've been there all day, Cal, any signs from the commissioners about how they might be considering this and considering this, you know, the testimony and the report?
Yeah, they've tried to keep it close to the vest, as you can imagine, Deb. You know, they've said little besides asking some questions of the various witnesses who have been testifying. What they have emphasized, though, is that they are not trying to determine Steve Wynn's guilt or innocence. So they're sort of following the language of the report from their investigators. They're saying that's not really what the issue is. The issue is much more forward-looking in their eyes. They want to see what is the business fitness of this company going into the future. And that has included a financial evaluation, Deb, and they hired an outside consulting firm to look into that. And on that grounds, they have determined that this bad press around Wynn Resorts has not hurt the company financially, that at least from that fiscal standpoint, it is still suitable to hold a license.
All right. WBUR's Callum Borchers reporting on today's State Gaming Commission hearing on the investigation into sexual misconduct allegations against the founder of Wynn Resorts and whether those allegations will cost the company its license to operate a casino in Everett. Cal, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
And now some frightening news involving Uber twice in the same week. A Boston-area Uber driver is facing charges of raping a passenger over the weekend. Dada Mayanja is being held on charges that he raped his passenger near the Hatch Shell early Saturday morning. Also, a South Carolina man is charged with impersonating an Uber driver and kidnapping and killing a college student. These incidents, of course, are raising questions about what ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft might do to improve safety. Janet Burns writes about tech, media, science, and Culture, and she's a contributor to Forbes and Gizmodo. She joins us now via Skype. Hi there.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we just start off with doing a brief explainer on how Uber and Lyft vet their drivers?
Sure. Well, both of the companies for several years have used third-party background checks for all of their drivers. The companies, it's also worth noting, they have lobbied pretty aggressively around the country on various issues pertaining to drivers' status and their treatment, including the nature of these required background checks. And different states and municipalities have different rules around these, but the companies all use this third-party company called Checker, and Lyft has been exploring some other options as well to run their drivers and reference motor vehicle records and local, state, and national databases. And as of last year, after some pushback that they've gotten in this area, Uber and Lyft have also announced that they would conduct these background checks every year. I think Lyft was a little ahead in that. And Uber has also introduced a policy which they call continuous checking, where the company is notified if a driver is arrested and charged with a new crime, after which the company will review that charge and see if it affects the eligibility. And with very few exceptions, such as in New York City, where ride-hail drivers have to undergo the same background check standards as taxi and limousine drivers, these background checks do not include fingerprinting, and the companies have faced criticism in the past few years that their third-party checks aren't strong enough.
Hmm. Yeah, and I know you wrote about this in Massachusetts. You wrote about this back in 2017. There are, some 8,000 Uber and Lyft drivers who failed Massachusetts background checks after first being cleared by ride-sharing companies. So I'm just wondering, since 2017, we've seen improvements here in Massachusetts. Some of those loopholes have been closed. Is that right? And now there are these re-screenings of drivers to make sure that they're vetted properly. Is that right? Is that what's supposed to be happening?
Yeah, you know, it seems to be an ongoing conversation, and it's admirable that Massachusetts is taking this on. They, as of 2017, are running their own checks, but also discussing the fact that sometimes these background checks can, on the one hand, be invasive if they are continuous, say they're, you know, monitoring a person's livelihood and legal status throughout the year, and also can preclude a group of workers from being Uber and Lyft drivers or in other driving industry roles just, you know, because of an infraction that they might have had a few years before. So it is, yeah, the companies are saying that they're working and seemingly taking steps to close some of these loopholes, and certain states and municipalities are trying to step in more and oversee these practices, but broadly, it's still left up to the two companies.
So are these incidents that we heard about this week, are these, would you say, sort of blips, and they're getting a lot of attention because folks aren't sure about safety and security measures in ride-sharing companies? Or would you say that this is a real problem and there are policies that need to be put in place and need to be enforced more strongly to make sure that there's better safety? What is it?
I would absolutely say that the companies and the governments that are working with them and charged with overseeing them need to take significant steps to improve safety for riders as well as drivers. And these two incidents have, served to be very startling and upsetting for people around the country for good reason. In Boston, you mentioned the driver who was charged with assaulting his passenger did not have a criminal record. It evinces that background checks are not the answer here. And then, of course, in South Carolina, this student who lost her life was hoping to climb into her Uber, but in fact stepped the wrong vehicle. And, you know, it brings up the issue of how are we demarcating these vehicles on the road. The companies will send their drivers plastic decals that they can put up on the inside of their windshields and peel off when they are off duty. Drivers can also print out temporary paper ones, which I will often see around in New York, particularly for Uber. But now, as a result of that issue happening this week in South Carolina, there's a proposed law for illuminated signs and not just simple decals to make it even clearer which cars are ride-hail vehicles and which are just passersby.
Right, but I'm curious about the background check issue. If in fact, it is something that's not coming up typically in a regular background check, what can these companies do? They can't really do anything.
Well, something that they have started to do, which is helpful, is including what's called an emergency button. And this allows riders and drivers around the U.S. and in a number of international locations right now to at least initiate a call with authorities through the app. On the rider's side, it will bring up information about the vehicle they're in. Unfortunately, they would have to verbally communicate those details to 911. The company Uber has also rolled out a sort of one-touch or voiceless app for sending their GPS information to authorities. But again, yeah, this is just a tool that unfortunately people would have to turn to once they're already in a dangerous situation. And drivers, as the numbers that we have so far will show, and General Bureau of Labor Statistics information about the driving industry as a whole show, that this is a very dangerous industry to be in, and that drivers could certainly use support from these companies in mm-hmm. training for safety and in helping maintain safety on the road.
Okay. Janet Burns writes about tech, media, science, and culture. She's a contributor to Forbes and Gizmodo. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. Coming up, revisiting the rent control debate in Massachusetts. We'll take your calls. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The issue of rent control is again up for debate in Massachusetts. Cambridge State Representative Mike Conley told Channel 5 that he plans to file legislation to address what he says is an emergency of displacement, homelessness, and rising costs.
If our bill passes, nothing would change the next day, but what would change is then cities and towns would have the ability to consider what would make sense for them.
But others, like Governor Charlie Baker, say rent control will not help and actually could make things worse.
Rent control will stifle the production of new housing. That's exactly the wrong direction to go in. What we need to do here in Massachusetts is build more housing.
We want to spend some time now talking about rent control in Massachusetts. So which is it? Do you support rent control? Do you remember the Massachusetts ballot question from 25 years ago that got rid of rent control? Are you a landlord? What would this mean for you? Would it help rein in the ever-rising housing prices in the Boston area? Listeners, we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We have a great panel in the studio with us to talk about this. First, Lisa Owens, Executive Director of City Life Vita Urbana, a Boston housing advocacy group. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deborah.
Also with us is Ralph or Skip Schloeming, Vice President and former Executive Director of the Small Property Owners Association.
Hi.
Hi. And we should say back in 1994, you and SPOA, the Small Property Owners Association, were instrumental in that statewide ballot initiative that ended rent control. So welcome back. Also, Barry Bluestone's with us. He's founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy and a professor at Northeastern. Hi there.
Hi, Deborah. And now retired.
Retired. Okay. Lucky Barry. Okay. So I want to give just a bit of history here. So Cambridge, Boston, and Brookline used to have rent control until that ballot question in 1994. And Oregon is now the first state in the country to enact statewide rent control. And that restricts annual rent increases to 7% plus inflation. So Massachusetts is, like many other states, debating debating this and whether this is a way that, that housing costs can be reined in. There are several proposals here. We mentioned the bill from Representative Connolly. There's another one that's a little narrower that's already in committee. So I guess we should start by talking with you, Lisa, and saying, do renters need this and why?
Absolutely. So no matter how old you are or how much you make or where you live, every person in the Commonwealth should have a safe, quality home that they can afford. And a home is so much more than a human need. A home is an anchor to family, to community. It's a platform for health, for well-being, and economic security. But the problem is that working families increasingly are forced to make impossible choices. Moms have to choose between rent and childcare. Seniors have to choose between rent and medical care. Adults have to choose between rent and
just caring. Because we're almost running out. Why rent control?
So rent control stabilizes housing immediately for low and moderate income people who are right now at risk of displacement. Rent control stabilizes communities by protecting the workers who live and work and play and make their cities and towns great. Rent control stabilizes the Commonwealth of Massachusetts by making sure that tenants, that workers, that homeowners don't have to continually look over their shoulders in fear of not knowing whether or not they can afford to live, you know, in their home month after month. So rent control will address the immediate displacement and affordability crisis right now, and it's the only policy tool that can meet both the scale of the problem and also at the speed at which we need solutions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Skip, I'm going to let you respond to that. It's efficient. It could bring in units quickly, and that's what we need because of high housing costs.
Right. Well, it does not create any new units at all. One of the first impacts of rent control is it stops all new rental housing construction, which is at least a long-term solution. And one of the critical problems is that it may secure housing for at present, but in the long run, over time, the working families, the low and moderate income families, even the minorities, get slowly kicked out of rent-controlled housing. And that experience was very clear in the 25 years that we had rent control, and it was one of the main reasons we were successful in getting rid of it. At the end of rent control, the state legislature gave two additional years of rent control to low and moderate income families, disabled and elderly. And only 6% of the rent-controlled tenants applied for it. So that means all of the other low and moderate income families had been displaced. And that's because the units are taken over by predominantly one-person households, very small ones, by the, you know, graduate students, young professionals. They loved their cheap apartments, and they rented more space. So effectively, they were just kicking out the low and moderate income families over time.
Lisa, I'm going to let you respond, but first I want to ask Barry, what can be done to make sure that the folks who rent control is intended to benefit actually benefit?
Well, unfortunately, I've studied this very closely over 20 years, and while I totally agree with Lisa that we have a serious problem, particularly for working families, rent control doesn't work very well. It works very well in the very short run to keep rents down for a year or two. The problem is two things happened. One, landlords who couldn't raise their rent just allowed their apartments and their units to deteriorate. And so even the older housing stock saw a decline in the value of that to the families living there. And second of all, as Skip said, it really put a damper on the production of new housing, and that's the ultimate answer is supply. So in the short run, it gives a little bit of help to those people in a rent-controlled unit, but in the long run, it actually exacerbates the problem we have. What I found is what I like is that lots of people are finally realizing we have a housing crisis. And so you're coming up with Charlie Baker's idea to do rezoning, which is good. You have people talking about expanding inclusionary zoning, which requires developers to set aside units or fund affordable units. We have Kim Janey and Lydia Edwards talking about a deed transfer tax to raise funds for it. All of these are worth considering, including rent control, but I think we need to have a really careful analysis of what the unintended consequences of each of these might be. Mm. And then we can come up with some real solutions that might not be immediate, but would solve the problem in the long run and not have a lot of unintended consequences in the middle run.
Okay, so I wonder, Lisa, what would you say to that? That there are, you know, it may work quickly, but there are real problems here and there may be unintended consequences that we're not thinking of.
Yeah, so with all due respect, Barry, unintended consequences is actually a trick. It's a smokescreen that hides the fact that the majority of renters in the city, in the Commonwealth, right? So the majority of renters are paying too much of our income on rent right now.
Exactly.
And when we lost rent control, although the deep-pocketed real estate forces were able to eke out a win, actually the percentage that we lost rent control by was 1.something%. Mm. We had a mandate even then, and it's important to say that Brookline, Cambridge, and Boston all unanimously voted for rent control. It's important to say that there's a mandate for this, and that actually the trick is, when we look at unintended consequences, what we're not looking at are the actual lived consequences of displacement right here and right now. We have 970,000 renters in the state of Massachusetts. We have 545,000 renters just in Greater Boston alone, and the majority of us are paying way too much of our income in rent, and that's part of a national trend. Mm. We need bold policy solutions that will impact people at speed and scale. And there is not one affordable housing policy option that we can use that outperforms rent control as a solution. And it's one solution among many, but it must be one solution in our toolbox.
Before you reply, sure. Steve, I just want to make sure we get some callers in here, because Pam is actually calling from Oregon to tell us about what they did in Oregon. We mentioned that briefly at the top of the program. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, how are you? You're good, listening good. From Oregon. Yeah, we're so excited.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really exciting to hear that Boston and Massachusetts are considering these protections. And I think what we realized in Oregon is that we know that there's growing evidence that rent control, especially when it's combined with other tenant protections, it's really good for local economies and community health and stability and just general family well-being, right? Like, we're hearing more and more that stable housing actually improves mental health, improves general mm-hmm. health outcomes. And so it's really critical for us. At least in Oregon, we felt like our victory has a lot to do with this growing momentum that rent control, other types of just cause eviction protections, really point to that housing is truly a human right. It's not
right. But can you just tell folks here who may not know what Oregon's law does? Because that's what we need to know. Okay, just briefly.
Yeah, Oregon's law, what it does is it eliminates no-cause evictions, which is evicting someone for no reason whatsoever and lack of predictability at any time after the first year of tenancy. And then it also caps rents for most renters at 7% plus the consumer price index.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And was that a tough fight in Oregon?
Absolutely. It was more than a 3-year fight on these particular policies in particular, but it's 20 years in the making.
What's the average rent, would you say, for a 2-bedroom in a city like Portland?
The average rent tends to be about $1,300 in Portland. And, you know, we know that especially with all the new construction available, that the rents are much, much higher than that. We see, you know, we were seeing rents increasing at rates above 5-7% in Portland. Mm-hmm. And Portland in particular has relocation assistance, so that also helps kind of stabilize Portland's market a little bit. Mm-hmm. But in places all over Oregon, especially in rural areas, we were seeing, you know, we were also seeing rents as high as 40% and 50%, and in some cases 100% increases.
All right, Pam, thanks so much for the call. I want to ask Skip, is this an interesting idea here to just limit the rate at which you could increase to say 7% plus inflation?
Right. It has its drawbacks. One of them is that the 7% limit is already higher than the average rent increase in Oregon. So that's already a problem, and there are demands to have it lowered immediately, right now. So one of the problems with rent control is that once it gets in, it usually gets worse because it creates a very strong political force among tenants, which are, you know, a bigger voter base than, say, landlords. And when they're getting $25, $50, $100, $200 off their rent every single month, they're going to vote. And one of the very interesting things, Lisa was quite right, that in 1994, it was only a very close margin that ended rent control. Mm-hmm. And the cities of Boston, Brookline, and Cambridge were in favor of rent control. But I want to let you know that in 2002, you know, that would be probably 8 years after rent control ended, Cambridge had a citywide referendum. And we, the Small Property Owners Association, my group, was very worried about that in the city that really loved rent control. We wrote letters to all the different property owner groups to tell them exactly how it would affect them. Like condo owners, if they move out of their condos, those are rented and they're rent controlled. And all of the property owners that were not controlled had super high tax bills to pay for the devaluation of all. Right. And the very interesting outcome is that in Cambridge, we won that in a landslide, 61% against rent control.
But I wonder, what do we do when we hear about, say, 50, 60% rent increases for some people and pushing people out of their communities? How do we make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, you know, there are attempts to try to just stop evictions, but that is really a problematic way to go. It just distorts what happens with evictions, who gets to live in the housing. So the longer-term proposals that I think Barry was here suggesting are the ones that we need to work on. We need to be able to supply more lower-rent housing. One of the options that our group is pushing very strongly is accessory apartments, which are the name for small-sized apartments built in basements, in empty spaces, in existing housing, in basements, in attics, in backyards, or taking large triple-decker-sized apartments and letting them be divided into half, which is now all prevented by zoning.
Mm-hmm.
And it just would take a zoning change, and landlords would provide what would be smaller-sized apartments at lower rents. And the people in the big apartments can, you know, move out. You know, they're young professionals and occupy these units.
Right. I want to remind listeners, we are taking your calls. Do you want to weigh in on the rent control issue? Massachusetts is jumping into this debate, as are many other communities around the country. What do you think? Do you support rent control? Do we need it in Massachusetts? What could be done to make sure that people can afford housing? 800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Bob, you're with us from Cambridge. You're on the air.
Yes. Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can. So tell us.
Okay. All right. Here's the deal. Here's the solution.
Okay, Doug.
I know about Cambridge Housing Authority, and they manage large buildings that house people, elderly, disabled, whatever. That model is probably the best. It doesn't have anything to do with controlling what should be a market situation. In Cambridge, for example, what you see is there's a lot of renovation going on, but those units are going to condo. Forget rentals. If you have people that are in need, you've got to have a quasi-public entity like Cambridge Housing Authority or Boston Housing Authority that builds specifically 10-story buildings or something like that magnitude and creates a whole bunch of apartments, and they can establish a reasonable rent because they are in touch with the people, with the poor people, with the elderly, with the disabled. That's the solution.
All right, Bob, thanks so much. Barry Bluestone, respond to that and to the Oregon proposal. Do we need to limit, rent increases, or do we need to have more public housing? Or do we need all of it? What do we need?
We need all of it. And you're right. In Cambridge, we actually have a great deal of public housing, which makes it possible for very low-income people to stay in Cambridge. The problem, I think, that we'd all talk about, Lisa, Skip, myself, is not the very poor, because we have programs for the very poor, not enough of them. We still have a homeless problem. But it's for working families who are being, as Lisa pointed out, pushed out of Boston, pushed out of Cambridge, pushed out of Somerville. So housing authorities can help. But I think I am going to fit right between these two friends of mine here and say I'd like to take a better look at the Oregon proposal. I haven't looked at it. It has a couple things I like the no-cause evictions. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't stop rent increases, but it caps the exorbitant ones. And if we could craft a rent control bill that had, let's say, capped the increases at 6, 7% plus the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, mm-hmm. which would be at 8 or 9% per year, I think that might protect us against the really exorbitant rent increases, which would help a little bit, without having all of the downsides that I talked about of limiting new construction of new apartments and also the deterioration of the old housing stock. So I think it's worth a look at. Skip's right. You might worry about how that would be, the camel's nose under the tent and then things get worse. But I'd be very interested in thinking about that. We have exactly the problem that Lisa's talking about. We need a set of solutions, again, as Lisa suggested, and this may be one if it's crafted very, very carefully.
I want to bring somebody else into the conversation here. Mark Drazen, Executive Director of the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, is on the line now. The council is the regional planning agency for 101 cities and towns around Boston. Mark, welcome into the conversation.
Thanks, Deb.
So tell us, what are your thoughts about this proposal in Oregon, or is there some sort of hybrid of several proposals that would help with affordable housing in Greater Boston in particular, and Massachusetts as a whole, and particularly help with what Barry has just mentioned, these exorbitant rent increases that we're hearing about?
I do think we have to look carefully at the proposal that's now underway in Oregon and see how it works and consider it. I think there are a number of things we can do. The first thing I would say, though, is we have to do something because, tenants are in crisis all over Massachusetts. One in four tenants throughout the state pays more than half their income for rent. And, we've been without rent control now for 25 years, and we haven't exactly solved the housing crisis through this free market system, in part because we're not building enough. We need to build more, but we can't solve this problem with the regulatory hand tied behind our backs. We have to have an adult conversation about regulation. I think there are a number of things we can do. First of all, we can consider establishing modest and reasonable limits on rent increases, as Barry said before, to deal basically with the exorbitant ones. Second thing we have to do, I think, is consider the right to counsel in eviction proceedings. Most people don't realize that if a tenant faces eviction in court, they don't have a right to counsel. But the results of proceedings when a tenant does have a lawyer are very different from the outcomes when a tenant does have an attorney. And, of course, the landlords almost always have an attorney. A third idea that I think we should very seriously consider is an idea that's coming to us out of California, and that is for a new kind of renter's insurance. As a society, we mandate or subsidize lots of different kinds of social insurance, flood insurance, unemployment, disability. So why not rents? And the source of funding could be a small tax on landlords based on the appreciation and the value of their property. And this would be a market-based system with the costs and benefits distributed broadly across all landlords and tenants. And I think that's another kind of innovative idea that we need to take a look at.
So what about, though, the idea of rent control as we now know it and the lessons that we learned here in Massachusetts, Mark? Good idea, not good idea?
Well, I wish it were that simple, Deb, but it isn't. I think that the type of rent control we had in the 70s and 80s was probably too onerous. And people disinvested, and apartments were people held on to apartments for decades because they had a good deal, and landlords didn't build more. But, you know, honestly, by the time we voted against rent control, I didn't vote against it, but by the time the state, by that very narrow margin, eliminated rent control in 1994, many of the most egregious elements of rent control had already been eliminated. It was already a substantially reformed system. And just because we didn't get it right one time doesn't mean we can't get it right if we try again. And I think modest limitations on rent increases, controls against no-cause evictions, reasonable limitations against condo conversions are something that we have to think about. You know, we're facing a very difficult crisis in Massachusetts. The average rent right now in Greater Boston is $2,500 a month. We've actually recently surpassed New York. And to say that we can solve this problem just by building our way out of it, it's a pipe dream. It's unrealistic. There's probably no agency in Massachusetts that pushes harder for the development of housing, for accessory dwelling units, for reform and relaxation of our zoning limitations on development. But supply alone is not the way out of this crisis. We have to consider reasonable regulation as well.
All right. I'm going to let Skip respond to some of those ideas, especially the idea about this government-funded sort of rent insurance. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, actually, the renter's insurance is an interesting idea that I hadn't heard of before. Mm-hmm. I have heard of something that's called a landlord insurance program that would allow those landlords who take what might be considered riskier tenants, which are the ones that they will ignore normally, but that may be at risk of, ex-cons may have a problem finding housing, and the homeless will. If the landlord takes on these riskier households, they are insured in the case of having to evict up to a certain amount of their legal costs, up to a certain amount of unpaid rent. And that means it's a fairly targeted program. It doesn't mean that everybody gets a subsidy, but it means that the owners are going to be willing to take, reasonably good prospects, but that might be riskier. And that would encourage them in a fairly simple way that I don't think is high cost to taxpayers.
And I just want to ask Mark one quick question here. Mark, some of these proposals that you've brought forward are proposals that will take time to implement. But to Lisa's point, can we wait right now? And what can we put in place, do you think, that would have some immediate results to help folks who are struggling?
Well, honestly, we could do right to counsel and eviction cases very quickly. Mm. We could probably seriously limit no-cause eviction, which I think would be a very important change. We could at least give cities and towns the opportunity to do modest limitations on rents. Public policy does take time to implement, but I feel that the situation is very, very urgent. We kind of sit here and we talk about these issues on the radio from an academic or a policy perspective, but there are people with real lived experiences who are suffering day to day. And it's necessary to try and deal with, their hardship more rapidly. So I think while we have this conversation around longer term solutions, it's important to ask ourselves, is there something we can do more quickly?
And Barry Bluestone, briefly, last word here. I read an estimate that says if rent control measures pass in all of the states and cities where they're now under consideration, nearly one-third of all renter households in the country would be affected. So this is a big conversation that's happening around the country right now. Do you think we will see some sort of action soon? I know we've said it's been dire for a while. Do we estimate that we'll see something soon?
I hope so. Yeah. The fact that even on this program, Deborah, you are introducing a whole bunch of ideas that even I haven't thought about, the Oregon type of rent control, which I think, as Mark suggests as well, is very worthwhile to mm-hmm. think about this. I am thrilled, after 20 years of putting out the Greater Housing Report Card through the Boston Foundation at Northeastern, that we finally have people really stepping up to the plate and coming up with a whole range of ideas. But we need to get action. We need it in the legislature. We need it in the city councils. And we need to have precisely the kind of discussion we've had around this radio station today.
All right. Barry Bluestone, founding director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy at Northeastern, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Also, I think that was Mark Drazen, Executive Director of the Metropolitan Area Planning Council. Skip Schloeming, Vice President and former Executive Director of the Small Property Owners Association. Thanks to you.
Thank you very much.
Lisa Owens, Executive Director of City Life Vita Urbana. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, the James Beard Awards are often called the Oscars of the food world, and of this year's finalists, seven of the nominees, including four in the chef and restaurant categories, have ties to Greater Boston. Here to tell us about the local nominees is Jacqueline Kane. She's Deputy Food Editor for Boston Magazine. Hi.
Hi.
So how well represented was Boston on this list?
You know, I'm always going to say Boston could have been better represented on this list. I think New England in general could have been better represented among the finalists, but the semifinalists, we had a lot of local talent represented on there, and that's great for them to get that recognition.
Yeah. So tell us who from Greater Boston's been nominated for Best Chef Northeast.
Yeah, so Best Chef Northeast is the one that people have their eye on the most. It picks the best chef from New England, and also it includes upstate New York in that category. So the five finalists in that category are Tiffany Faison. She owns Tiger Mama, Sweet Cheeks, and Fool's Errand in the Fenway. Mm-hmm. Cassie Puma, who is, she's of Sarma in Somerville. Tony Messina of Uni. And then two Providence, Rhode Island chefs, James Mark of North and Benjamin Sukul of Oberlin.
Now there are some repeat names here. So what's up with that?
So these five chefs, four of them were Best Chef Northeast finalists in 2018. Last year, Chef Karen Akunowitz, who just opened Fox and the Knife in South Boston.
Formerly Myers and Chang,
yep,
right?
Formerly. Mm-hmm. Yep. So she was honored for her near decade of skill and experience with Myers and Chang. And so, yeah, this year it's four of the same finalists. The new addition is James Mark of North from Providence.
So what does that say, do you think, if we're hearing the same names over and over again?
So, yeah, I've been talking about this with a lot of friends in the industry and a lot of folks who watch this closely, and I do think the five chefs are seriously talented people that we've read about before. So they are chefs that have some name recognition, chefs who've been, you know, maybe with Tiffany Faison's case, she has a recurring cameo on the show Chopped. So she gets some name recognition. You think national audience, some chefs with some national attention a little bit there. Whereas some of the other semifinalists were some of the more up-and-coming, really talented people who you need to know when you're here in Boston. But I could see not getting that national attention.
Mm. And, you know, you mentioned Cassie Puma of Sarma in Somerville. Now, 2 years ago, we talked with her on this show about some of Sarma's signature dishes and Mediterranean food in general. We have a little clip of that. Let's listen.
I think it's, you know, exciting food. It has lots of spices and herbs and really deep flavors. It's rich and satisfying without being heavy or, you know, cloying. I'm, you know, half Greek, so I kind of grew up eating a lot of feta cheese and olives and things like that, so I think it's kind of in my blood.
So what is it, do you think, that Jacqueline, that the chefs, the judges, rather, seem to love about Sarma?
Yeah, so she nailed it. Those bold flavors. Mm. Every time you go to Sarma, it's an absolutely amazing meal because it's very unexpected. It's not only those flavors that she was talking about, unexpected spices and things like that, but constantly there's food coming at you at Sarma. It's not just ordering off the menu there, but they bring stuff around. It's very exciting.
So it's also the whole experience of the dining as much as the cooking itself.
Definitely.
Was there anybody left off the list that should have been on it?
So one category in particular, I was disappointed to not see a familiar name. It's the Rising Stars category. Mm-hmm. So this honors chefs who are up and coming across the national scene. For the last 5 years, since 2015, Chef Irene Lee's name has been on that list. She owns and operates Mei Mei in Brookline. And so 5 years being, you know, as a semifinalist for that category, I personally think Irene Lee's star has risen, and I would have liked to see her on that category as a finalist.
You know, Portland, Maine, let's talk about that. Everyone calls Portland the foodie city of New England. It was awarded the 2018 Restaurant City of the Year by Bon Appetit magazine, right? So, but no Portland chefs on this list this year. Was that surprising to you?
It was extremely surprising to me. I totally agree with you. Portland's one of my absolute favorite cities. I feel very fortunate that it's just a short drive from Boston. I love eating in Portland. I love drinking in Portland. So there was some Portland representation. Rob Todd, who's the founder of Allagash Brewing Company, is nominated as an outstanding beer professional this year, which is exciting for me. But other than that, I was very surprised to not see them as a finalist. They were a semifinalist. The restaurant 4th Street was a semifinalist for Best Restaurant category, but it didn't make the shortlist.
Mm. Now, the James Beard Awards have been responding to Me Too accusations in the restaurant industry, and they asked their judges last year to consider chef behavior, right? And they're trying to make, they said, their committee that makes that awards these awards more diverse. Is that affecting things?
Yeah, so yes, last year, so this year was when they made a really concerted effort to change their nomination process. I feel like we need to see how that shakes out. Whereas last year, I think the statistic that they cite is that more than 50% of the awards were for women and people of color. So that is a little bit better of representation there. But with women, with recognizing more females, I think we're seeing more of that for sure.
All right. Jacqueline Kane, Deputy Food Editor for Boston Magazine. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
2019 James Beard Award winners will be announced in Chicago May 6th. And we want to let you know about and invite you to an event this Friday when our show goes live. Radio Boston will broadcast live from WBUR City Space Friday, April 5th. It'll be an hour of lively conversations. Our weekend review panel will also be talking with New York Times bestselling author Lori Gottlieb, plus the New Hampshire man who collected 700 Dunkin' Donuts cups and turned them into a surfboard. That's just a sampling of our live show Friday at 3 at WBUR City Space. Details are at our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.